The Gulag Archipelago, Volume 2, Section 2, Continued. Cassette 3, Side 1.
I didn't like either his face or his manner, that Senin. He used to flash his soft eyes too much, but he was, oh, so cultured, so well-mannered, so different from all the rest of our jailers, boors, incompetents, illiterates. Senin was no more and no less than a university student, a fourth-year student, but I simply don't remember in which faculty. He was evidently quite ashamed of his MVD uniform, fearing his fellow students might run into him on the street when he was wearing his blue shoulder boards, and therefore when he came for his duty periods, he put on his uniform at the gatehouse, and when he left, he took it off. Now here is a contemporary hero for our novelists. Could one imagine a progressive student in Starist Times moonlighting as a jailer in a prison? However, cultured or not, it cost him no trouble at all to send an old man scurrying on errands, or to hand out 3 days in punishment block to a slogger. But he very much liked to conduct an intellectual conversation in our room, so as to show that he understood our delicate souls, and so that we ourselves would value the delicacy of his soul. So it was this time. He was telling us something fresh about the life of the city, something about a new film, and suddenly, imperceptibly to the others, he clearly motioned to me to go out into the corridor. I went out, not understanding. After a certain number of polite sentences, so it wouldn't be obvious, Senin also got up and came after me. And he instructed me to go immediately to the office of the security officer. The stairway leading there led nowhere else, so one would not run into anyone on it. There sat the old hoot owl. I had not yet met him. I went with a sinking heart. What was I afraid of? I was afraid of what every camp inmate fears, that he might start to paste a second term on me. Not a year had passed since my interrogation, and everything within me still ached from the mere sight of an interrogator behind a desk. And what if my previous case were to be delved into again? A few pages more from my diary, maybe some letters. Knock, knock, knock. Come in. I opened the door. A small, cozily furnished room, as if it were not in Gulag at all. There was even enough room for a small divan. Maybe he was bringing our women in here, too. And for a Philips radio on a bookstand. Its bright-coloured little tuning eye gleamed, and some soft, very pleasant melody was pouring gently out of it. I had become quite unused to such purity of sound and such music. I instantly softened. Somewhere life was going on. My Lord, we had grown so used to believing that our own life was life itself, but it was going on somewhere out there, somewhere out there. Sit down. On the desk was a lamp beneath a calming shade. The security chief sat in an armchair behind the desk. Like Senin, he had that same intelligent, dark-haired, impenetrable appearance. My chair was also semi-upholstered. How pleasant it was, if only he wouldn't begin to accuse me of anything, if only he wouldn't begin dragging all that old nonsense out again. But no, his voice was not hostile at all. He asked me in general about my life, how I was feeling, how I was adjusting to the camp, whether it was comfortable for me in the trustees' room. No, that was not how they began an interrogation. And where had I heard that beautiful melody? And then came a quite natural question. It could even have been out of just plain curiosity. Well, and after everything that has happened to you, after everything you have suffered, are you still a Soviet person, or not? Well, what could I answer? You, my descendants, will never be able to understand this. What should I answer now? I hear, yes, I can hear you normal free people shouting at me from 1990. Go ahead and send him to... Or perhaps my descendants will no longer express themselves in that kind of language. I think in Russia they will. So they imprisoned you, they cut your throat, and they still want you to be a Soviet person. In actual fact, after all my prisons, after all my encounters with others, when I was engulfed with information from the whole world, How on earth could I still be a Soviet person? Where and when has anything Soviet ever been able to withstand completeness of information? And if I had already been re-educated as much by prison as I had been educated by it, I ought to have cut him off then and there, of course. No, go to... I'm tired of beating my brains out over you. Let me rest after work. But then we had all grown up to be obedient fellows.
After all, when it came to who's against, who abstains, there was absolutely no way you could raise your hand. No way.
So how could even a convicted man twist his tongue around the words, I am not a Soviet person? In the OSO decree, it stated that I was anti-Soviet, I said evasively. The OSO. And he waved it away without the slightest respect. But you yourself, what do you feel? Are you still a Soviet person, or have you changed and become embittered? That melody continued to play softly and so purely, and our syrupy, sticky, and inconsequential conversation didn't stick to it. Lord, how pure and how beautiful human life can be, but because of the egotism of those who have power, we're never able to attain it. Was it Moniudsko? No, it wasn't Moniudsko. Or Borzhak? No, it wasn't Borzhak. Go away and let me be, dog, and let me listen. Why should I be embittered? I acted astonished. Why, indeed, for 10 letters or so, 8 years. And that was not even a full year for each letter. To be embittered was quite out of the question. It would already smell of a new term. And so that means you are Soviet? The security chief pressed at me, sternly but encouragingly. The important thing was not to answer sharply, not to disclose what I had become by then. Say now you are anti-Soviet, and a new camp case would be set in motion, and they would solder a new term onto you very easily. In your own heart inside, how do you think of yourself? It was so fearsome. Winter and blizzards, going to the Arctic. And here I had everything well arranged. I had a dry place to sleep, and it was warm, and there were even bedclothes. In Moscow, my wife came to visit me and brought parcels. Where would I be sent? And why should I go if I could stay behind? What was there shameful in saying, Soviet? The system was socialist. For myself... Yes, well, Soviet. Aha, so you are Soviet. Now that's something else again. The security chief was gladdened. So now you and I can talk as true Soviet people. That means you and I share the same ideology. We have common goals. Only our lodgings were different. And you and I must act in unity. You help us, and we will help you. I felt I had already slipped downward, and there was still that music, and he kept tossing and tossing his neat little nooses. I had to help him keep in touch with what was going on. I might choose to overhear certain conversations. I was to report on them. Well, that was something I would never do. Cold-bloodedly inside myself, I knew that quite well. Whether I was Soviet or not was immaterial. Don't sit around waiting for me to report political conversations to you. However, caution, caution. Somehow, I had to cover my tracks delicately. That's something I wouldn't be able to do, I replied to him with something sounding like regret. Why not? My ideological colleague grew more severe. Well, because it's not in my character. How can I put this to you politely, you bastard? Because I don't listen, I don't remember. He noted there was something between me and the music, and clicked off the radio. Silence. The warm, bright-coloured eye of the good world was extinguished. In the office, just the hoot owl and myself. It was in deadly earnest now. If only they had known the rules of chess. If moves are repeated 3 times in a row, a draw is declared. But no, they were lazy in everything else, but not in this. 100 times he monotonously checked me from one and the same square of the chessboard, and 100 times I hid behind the same pawn and then sallied out from behind it again. He had no taste at all, but he had all the time in the world. And I put myself in eternal check by declaring myself a Soviet person. Of course, there was some slight variation each of the 100 times, a different word, a different intonation. An hour passed, and another. In our cell, they were already asleep. But there was no need for him to hurry. This was his work. How could I get shut of him? What sticky people they are. He had already hinted at a prisoner transport and at general work, and he had already expressed his suspicion that I was an inveterate enemy, and had gone back again to the hope that I was an inveterate friend. Yield, I couldn't. Neither did I want to go on a prisoner transport in winter. And with heavy heart I wondered how it all would end. All of a sudden he switched the conversation to the thieves. He had heard from the jailer Senin that I had spoken out sharply against the thieves, that I had had a run-in with them. I came to life. This was a new move. Yes, I did hate them. But I know that you love them. And in order to go right at my tenderest point, he drew the following picture. I have a wife in Moscow. Without a husband, she has to walk the streets by herself, sometimes even at night. People on the street often have their clothes taken off them by those very same thieves who escaped from camp. No, by those you amnesty. So would I really refuse to report to the security chief if I should happen to learn of preparations for escape by the thieves? Well, that was different. The thieves were enemies, pitiless enemies, and against them maybe any methods were good. Anyway, good or not, the main thing was that it was a good out for me. At least it seemed so. I could. That I could do. You said it. You said it. And the devil only needs one little word. And instantly a clean sheet of paper fluttered onto the table in front of me. Pledge. I, the undersigned, pledge to report to the camp security officer any escapes planned by prisoners. But we were talking only about the thieves. And who escapes except the thieves? And how am I going to write the word thieves in an official document? That's slang. It makes sense just as it is. But the entire meaning is changed. No, now I see that you are not one of us, and that it is necessary to talk with you in an entirely different way, and not here. Oh, what fearsome words, not here. When there is a blizzard outside the window, when you are a trustee and live in a friendly chamber of monstrosities, where is it that not here? In Le Fortovo? And what does it mean, in an entirely different way? Anyway, in the last analysis, there hadn't been a single escape during my time in this camp. It was about as likely as a meteorite falling. And if there were going to be escapes, what fool would talk about them ahead of time? And that meant I would never know. And that meant there would be nothing for me to report. In the last analysis, this wasn't a bad way out of it. But couldn't we really get along without that paper? That's the system. I sighed. I reassured myself with unspoken qualifications and put my signature down, selling my soul. Selling my soul to save my body. All done? Can I go? Oh, not at all. There was also one on non-disclosure, but farther up the same piece of paper. You must choose a pseudonym for yourself. A pseudonym? Ah, you mean a conspiratorial nickname. Yes, 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 of course. All informers have to have a conspiratorial nickname. Good Lord, how swiftly I had fallen. He had outplayed me after all. The chessmen had moved, and it was checkmate. And all my imagination fled, and my mind went blank. I can always find names for dozens of heroes. Now I couldn't think of even one little nickname. Mercifully, he suggested to me, well, what about Vetrov? And finally I wrote at the end of the pledge, Vetrov. Those six letters are branded in shameful grooves on my memory. After all, I had wanted to die among human beings. I had been prepared to die among human beings. How did it turn out that I had remained to live among curs? And the commissioner tucked my pledge away in the safe. This was his output for the night shift. And he courteously explained to me that I must not come to his office, that this would cause suspicion. The jailer Senin was a trustworthy person, and all my reports, denunciations, could be transmitted secretly through Senin. That's how birds are snared, beginning with the tiny little claw. That particular year, I probably wouldn't have been able to stop myself at that edge. After all, if you can't hold on to the mane, you'll not be able to hold on by the tail either. Once you start sliding down, you'll slide down further. But something helped me to hold back. Whenever I met Senin, he used to urge me on. Well? Well? I used to spread my hands. I had heard nothing. I was regarded with hostility by the thieves and was unable to get close to them. And then, as if out of spite, although there had been no escapes at all of a sudden a lousy thief escaped from our camp. All right, then, report on something else. On the brigade. On the room, Senin insisted. I kept insisting that I hadn't promised to report on anything else. By now it was already getting on towards spring. Nonetheless, I had gained a little by giving too narrow a pledge. And at this point I was jerked out of the camp and into a shirashka on special orders from the ministry. And that's how I got by. Never again did I have to sign as Vetrov. But even today I shudder when I encounter that name. Oh, how difficult it is, how difficult it is to become a human being, even if you have survived the front and bombing and been blown up by landmines. That's still only the very beginning of heroism. That's still not the whole thing. Many years passed. I had been in shirashkas and special camps. I bore myself independently, ever more impudently, and never again did the security section spoil me with its good offices. And I grew used to living with the gay conviction that on my case file they had stamped, "Do not recruit." I was sent into exile. I lived there for nearly 3 years. The dispersal of the exiles had already begun too, and several of the exiled nationalities had already been liberated. By this time, those of us who remained used to joke when we went to report in at the commandant's headquarters. The 20th Congress had also passed, and everything seemed gone once and for all. I made jolly plans for my return to European Russia as soon as I was released. And suddenly, when I was leaving the school courtyard one day, a well-dressed Kazakh, in civilian clothes, greeted me by name and patronymic, and hurried over to shake my hand. "Let's go and talk," he nodded amiably in the direction of the commandant's headquarters. "I have to have my lunch," I waved him away. "And will you be free later this evening?" "I won't be free this evening either." In my free evenings, I was writing a novel. "Well, when will you be free tomorrow?" He had caught me, and I had to fix an appointment for the next day. I thought he would have something to say about my case being reconsidered. Just before this, I had made a mistake. I had written a petition to the higher-ups, just like the Orthodox communists, which meant I had got myself into the situation of a petitioner. That was something state security couldn't let by. But the province security officer had triumphantly taken over the office of the district MVD chief, had locked the door, and was clearly preparing for a conversation that was to last many hours, and that was rendered all the more complicated by the fact that he didn't speak Russian very well. Despite this, by the end of the first hour, I realized that he was interested not in reconsideration of my case, but in recruiting me as an informer. Evidently, with the release of a section of their exiles, the ranks of the informers had grown sparse. I found all this both ridiculous and vexing. Vexing because I regarded each half hour as very precious, and ridiculous because in March 1956 this kind of conversation grated on me with its bad timing, like the clumsy scraping of a knife across a plate. Very gently I tried to explain this untimeliness to him, but he would have none of it. Like a serious bulldog, he tried not to let up on his grip. Every sort of relaxation in the Soviet Union always reaches the provinces after a delay of 3, 5, or 10 years. And it is only tightening up which is instantaneous. He hadn't the slightest idea of what 1956 was to be like. Then I reminded him that the MGB had been abolished, but he eagerly and happily demonstrated to me that the KGB was exactly the same thing, with the same personnel and the same tasks. But by that year, I had already developed some sort of cavalier carelessness toward their glorious institution. I felt that it would be quite in the spirit of the epoch to send him exactly where he and his colleagues deserved. I feared no direct consequences for myself. They couldn't happen during that glorious year. And it would have been great fun simply to leave, slamming the door behind me. But I stopped to think first. What about my manuscripts? For whole days at a time they lay there in my tiny hut, protected only by a weak little lock, yes, and concealed on the inside with an additional small ruse. At night I would get them out and write away. If I were to enrage the KGB, they would look for a chance of revenge, something compromising, and they might just find my manuscripts. No, I simply had to bring this to an end, peaceably. Oh, my country, oh, my accursed country, where in its very freest months the human being most inwardly free could not permit himself to antagonize the gendarmes. He could not fling in their faces everything he thought. I am gravely ill, that's the problem. My illness doesn't allow me to look around and snoop. I have enough troubles. Let's leave it at that. Of course, this was a pitiful way of getting out of it, because I was recognizing their actual right to recruit, and what I should have done was to ridicule and deny that right. It was a refusal, on my knees. And he still didn't accept it, the smart aleck. For half an hour more he kept trying to prove to me that even a gravely ill person also ought to collaborate. But when he saw that I was totally immovable, he took another tack. Do you have an extra certificate? What kind? Certifying that you are so ill? Yes, I have a certificate. Then bring it to me. Yes, he had to have his output, too, for his own workday. Justification that I had been correctly selected as a candidate, but that they had not known that this person was gravely ill. The certificate was required not merely for him to read, but to be stapled into the case file, and thereby to end the whole attempt. I gave him the document, and with that we were quits. Those were the freest months in our country in a whole half century. And what about the person who had no medical excuse? The skill of the security officer consisted in immediately picking the right master key.
In one of the Siberian camps, a native of one of the Baltic countries, you, who knew Russian well, which is why the choice fell on him, was summoned to the chief.
And there in the chief's office sat an unfamiliar captain with an aquiline nose and the hypnotic gaze of a cobra. "Shut the door tight," he warned very gravely, as if enemies were about to burst in, without lowering his burning eyes, which stared at you from beneath shaggy brows. And inside you everything wilted, something burned and suffocated him. Before summoning you, of course, the captain had gathered all the information available about him, and without even having seen him, had determined that keys 1, 2, 3, and 4 would all be of no avail, that here only the last and strongest key could be used. But he kept staring for several minutes into you's unclouded, defenseless eyes, checking him out with his own eyes, and at the same time depriving him of his willpower, and already invisibly raising above him that which would immediately descend upon him. The security chief took time for only the briefest introduction, speaking not in the tone of an abstract political catechism, but tensely, as if something were about to explode today or tomorrow right there in their own camp. Do you know the world is divided into two camps, and one will be defeated, and we know very well which it will be? Do you know which? So that's how it is. If you want to survive, you must break away from the doomed capitalist shore and swim across to the new shore. Are you familiar with Lapsus to the new shore? And he added a few more such phrases, and did not for a moment lower his hot, threatening gaze, and having finally confirmed in his own mind the number of the key, he then asked, with alarmed seriousness, And what about your family? And one by one, without ceremony, he reeled off all their names, and he knew the ages of the children, too. That meant he had already familiarized himself with the family. That was very serious. You understand, of course, he pronounced hypnotically, that you and your family are a single whole. If you make a mistake and perish, your family will immediately perish, too. We do not permit the families of traitors, his voice grew more meaningful, to go on living in the healthy Soviet environment. So make your choice between the two worlds, between life and death. I am offering you an opportunity to pledge to assist the security section. In case you refuse, your entire family will be immediately imprisoned in camp. In our hands we have full power, how right he was, and we are not accustomed to backtrack on our decisions. Once again he was right. Since we have chosen you, you will work with us. All this was loosed suddenly on Yu's head. He was not prepared for it. He would never have thought of it. He had considered that only scoundrels became informers, but that they might approach him? A blow, direct, without waste motion, without the cushion of time. And the captain was waiting for his answer, and was about to explode right then, and then everything would explode. And Yu took thought. What is there that is really impossible for them? When have they ever spared anyone's family? They didn't hesitate to liquidate the Kulak families right down to tiny children, and they even wrote about it proudly in the newspapers. Yu had also seen the work of the organs in 1940 and 1941 in the Baltic states, and had gone to the prison yards to look at the pile of executed prisoners during the Soviet retreat. And in 1944 he had heard the Baltic broadcasts from Leningrad. Like the captain's gaze at this moment, they had been full of threats and had breathed revenge. They promised reprisals against all, against every last person who had aided the enemy. But every teacher, every factory worker, every streetcar conductor, everyone who had had to earn his bread with his work, had one and all aided the enemy. The only persons who didn't aid the enemy were the speculator at the market and the partisan in the forest. The extreme tone of these thoughtless Leningrad broadcasts pushed several hundred thousands of persons into flight into Scandinavia in 1944. And so, what was there to compel them to show mercy now? To ask for it was useless. It was necessary to choose. But here is what Yu, himself a victim of the myth of the organs, did not yet realize. That machine possessed no such magnificent coordination and interlinked responsiveness as would ensure that when he refused today to become an informer in a Siberian camp, his family would be hauled off to Siberia in a week's time. And there was one more thing he didn't realize either. No matter how poor his opinion of the organs, they were even worse than he thought. The hour would strike soon when all these families, all these hundreds of thousands of families, would troop off into common exile, where they would perish, without any reference to how the fathers were behaving in camp. Fear for himself would not have shaken him, but Yu pictured his wife and daughter in camp conditions, in these same barracks where lechery wasn't even curtained off, where there was no defense whatever for any woman under 60. And he shuddered. The correct key had been picked. None other would have opened the door, but this one did. But he still dragged things out a bit. I have to think it over. All right, think it over for 3 days, but don't talk it over with even a single person. You will be shot for disclosure. And Yu goes to get advice from a fellow national, the very same, in fact, against whom he is being told to write his first denunciation. And, in fact, they edit it together. For this friend admits it is impossible to risk his family. On his second visit to the captain, Yu signs the devil's receipt and receives his assignment and his contact. He is not to go to the office anymore. He is to conduct all his business through the unconvoyed trustee, Frol Ryabinin. This is an important constituent of the work of the camp security chief. These residents are scattered throughout the camp. Frol Ryabinin is the most vociferous of all among the people. A prankster. Frau Ryabinin is a popular personality. Frau Ryabinin has some sort of under-the-counter work or other, and a separate cabin of his own, and always has money. With the security chief's help, he has got into the depths and currents of camp life, and he hovers in them comfortably at home. Such residents as he are the cables on which the whole network hangs. Frau Ryabinin instructs you that he must transmit his reports in a dark nook. In our work, the main thing is conspiracy. He summons him to his private quarters. The captain is dissatisfied with your report. You have to write so that there's material against a person. I'm going to teach you how. And this stinking snoot teaches the wan, depressed intellectual you how to write filth against people. But Yu's downcast look leads Ryabinin to his own conclusion. It is necessary to liven this ninny up, to heat him up a little. And he says to him in a friendly way, "Listen, your life is a hard one. You sometimes want to buy something to add to your bread ration. The captain wants to help you. Here, take this." And he takes a 50-ruble bill from his billfold. And this is the captain's, and that is how free of auditors they are. And maybe they are the only ones in the whole country. And he shoves it at you. And suddenly, at the sight of this pale green toad, which has been pushed into his hands, all the spells cast by the Cobra captain, all the hypnosis, all the constraint, even all the fear for his family, all that has taken place, its entire meaning, is objectified in this loathsome bill with its greenish phlegm, these commonplace Judas silver pieces. And without even stopping to think what will happen to his family, with the natural gesture of warding off filth, you pushes away the 50-ruble bill, and the uncomprehending Ryabinin shoves it at him again, and you throws it on the floor and gets up, already relieved, already free both of the moral teachings of Ryabinin and of his signature given to the captain. Free of those paper conditions in the face of the great duty of a human being. He leaves without asking permission. He walks through the camp compound on legs light as air. I'm free! I'm free! Well, not entirely so. A stupid security chief would have kept on hauling him in, but the Cobra captain understood that the stupid Ryabinin had spoiled the threading, had used the wrong key. And the pincers no longer sought out you in that camp, and Ryabinin would pass him without greeting. You calmed down and was glad. And at this point they began to send the 58s off to the special camps, and he was sent to Steplag. And he thought that this prisoner transport would break the chain all the more. But not at all. A notation evidently remained in his file. At his new place, you was summoned to a colonel. They tell me you agreed to work with us, but that you do not deserve our trust. Perhaps they didn't explain it to you clearly. However, this colonel inspired no fear in you. And, in addition, Yu's family, like the families of many of the inhabitants of the Baltic states, had been resettled in Siberia by this time. There was no doubt about it. He had to get them off his back. But what pretext could he use? The colonel turned him over to a lieutenant for the latter to work him over, and this lieutenant jumped up and down and threatened and promised, while you kept trying to find a way of forcefully and decisively turning them down. Though he was an enlightened and irreligious person, you discovered that the only defense against them was to hide behind Christ. This was not very honest, but it was a sure thing. He lied. I must tell you frankly that I had a Christian upbringing, and therefore it is quite impossible for me to work with you. And that ended it, and all the lieutenant's chatter, which had by then lasted many hours, simply stopped. The lieutenant understood he had drawn a bad number. We need you like a dog needs five legs, he exclaimed petulantly. Give me a written refusal. Once again, written. And write just that, explaining about your damned God. Apparently they have to close the case of every informer with a separate piece of paper, just as they open it with one. The reference to Christ satisfied the lieutenant completely, none of the security officers would accuse him subsequently of failing to use every effort he could. And does the impartial reader not find that they flee from Christ like devils from the sign of the cross, from the bells calling to matins? And that is why our Soviet regime can never come to terms with Christianity, and the French communists' promises to the contrary mean nothing. Chapter 13. Hand over your second skin, too. Can you behead a man whose head has already been cut off? You can. Can you skin the hide off a man when he has already been skinned? You can. This was all invented in our camps. This was all devised in the archipelago. So let it not be said that the brigade was our only Soviet contribution to world penal science. Is not the second camp term a contribution too? The waves which surge into the archipelago from outside do not die down there and do not subside freely, but are pumped through the pipes of the second interrogation. Oh, blessed are those pitiless tyrannies, those despotisms, those savage countries, where a person once arrested cannot be arrested a second time, where once in prison he cannot be re-imprisoned, where a person who has been tried cannot be tried again, where a sentenced person cannot be sentenced again. But in our country everything is permissible. When a man is flat on his back, irrevocably doomed and in the depths of despair, how convenient it is to poleaxe him again. The ethics of our prison chiefs are, beat the man who's down. And the ethics of our security officers are, use corpses as stepping stones. We may take it that camp interrogations and camp court were born on Solovki, although what they did there was simply to push them into the bell tower basement and finish them off. During the period of the five-year plans and of the metastases, they began to employ the second camp term instead of the bullet. For how otherwise, without second or third or fourth terms, could they secrete in the bosom of the archipelago and destroy all those marked down for destruction? The generation of new prison terms, like the growing of a snake's rings, is a form of archipelago life. As long as our camps thrived and our exile lasted, this black thread hovered over the heads of the convicted, to be given a new term before they had finished the first one. Second camp terms were handed out every year, but most intensively in 1937 and 1938, and during the war years. In 1948 to 1949, the burden of second terms was transferred outside. They overlooked, they missed, prisoners who should have been re-sentenced in camp, and then had to haul them back into camp from outside. These were even called repeaters, whereas those re-sentenced inside didn't get a special name. And it was a mercy, an automated mercy, when in 1938, second camp terms were given out without any second arrest, without a camp interrogation, without a camp court, when the prisoners were simply called up in brigades to the records and classification section and told to sign for their second terms. For refusing to sign, you were simply put in punishment block, as for smoking where it wasn't allowed. And they also had it all explained to them in a very human way. We aren't telling you that you are guilty of anything, but just sign that you have been informed. In Kolyma, that's how they gave out tenors, but in Vorkuta, it was even less severe, 8 years plus 5 years by the OSO. And it was useless to try to get out of it as if, in the dark infinity of the archipelago, 8 was in any way distinct from 18, or a tenor at the start from a tenor at the end of a sentence. The only important thing was that they did not claw and tear your body today. Now we can understand. The epidemic of camp sentences in 1938 was the result of a directive from above. It was there at the top that they suddenly came to their senses and realized that they had been handing out too little, that they had to pile it on and shoot some too, and thus frighten the rest. But the epidemic of camp cases during the war was stimulated by a happy spark from below, too, by the features of popular initiative. In all likelihood, there was an order from above that during the war, the most colourful and notable individuals in each camp, who might become centres for rebellion, had to be suppressed and isolated. The bloody local boys immediately sensed the riches in this vein, their own deliverance from the front. This was evidently guessed in more than one camp and rapidly taken up as useful, ingenious, and a salvation. The camp Czechists also helped fill up the machine gun embrasures, but with other people's bodies. Let the historian picture to himself the pulse of those years. The front was moving east. The Germans were around Leningrad, outside Moscow, in Voronezh, on the Volga, and in the foothills of the Caucasus. In the rear, there were even fewer men. Every healthy male figure aroused reproachful glances. Everything for the front. There was no price too big for the government to pay to stop Hitler. And only the camp officers, and their confreres in state security, were well-fed, white, soft-skinned, idle, all in their places in the rear. This camp godfather, for example, how badly he needed to stay alive. And the farther into Siberia and the north they were, the quieter things were. But we must soberly understand theirs was a shaky prosperity, due to end at the first outcry. Bring out those rosy-cheeked, smart camp fellows. No battle experience, so they had ideology. And they would be lucky to end up in the police or in the behind-the-lines obstacle detachments. But it could happen otherwise. Otherwise, it was into officer battalions and be thrown into the Battle of Stalingrad. In the summer of 1942, they picked up whole officer training schools and hurled them into the front, uncertified, their courses unfinished. All the young and healthy convoy guards had already been scraped up for the front, and the camps hadn't fallen apart. It was all right, and they wouldn't fall apart if the security officers were called up either. There were already rumors. Draft deferment, that was life. Draft deferment, that was happiness. How could you keep your draft deferment? Easy. You simply had to prove your importance. You had to prove that if it were not for Czechist vigilance, the camps would blow apart, that they were a cauldron of seething tar, and then our whole glorious front would collapse. It was right here in the camps in the tundra and the taiga that the white-chested security chiefs were holding back the fifth column, holding back Hitler. This was their contribution to victory, not sparing themselves. They conducted interrogation after interrogation, exposing plot after plot. Until now, only the unhappy, worn-out camp inmates, tearing the bread from each other's mouths, had been fighting for their lives. But now the omnipotent Czechist security officers shamelessly entered the fray. You croak today, me tomorrow. Better you should perish and put off my death, you dirty animal. And so they cooked up a rebel group in Ust-Vim, 18 persons. They wanted, of course, to disarm the militarized guard, get its weapons away from it, half a dozen old rifles. What then? It is hard to picture the scale of the plan. They wanted to raise the entire north, to march on Vorkuta, on Moscow, to join up with Mannerheim. And telegrams and reports flew to the top. A big plot had been neutralized. There was unrest in the camps. The security staff had to be strengthened. And what was this? Plots were discovered in every camp. More plots. Still more. Ever larger in scale. And ever broader. Oh, those perfidious last leggers. They were just feigning that they could be blown over by the wind. Their paper-thin, pellagra-stricken hands were secretly reaching for the machine guns. Oh, thank you, security section. Oh, savior of the motherland, the third section. And a whole gang sat there in that third section in the Jida camps of Buryat, Mongolia, chief of the security operations section Sokolov, interrogator Mironenko, security officers Kalashnikov, Sosikov, Osintsev. We've fallen behind. Everyone else has plots, and we have fallen behind.
This book is continued at this point on the other side of this cassette.